We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Don Durrett, author, investor, and founder of goldstockdata.com. How are you today, Don?
Tom, great. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. And of course, today we're recording on May 1st, the afternoon here. And it seems like we have a lot to talk about, a lot of data to talk about. You know, I always appreciate getting to check in with you about once every quarter to really discuss the changes in what the data is showing us and kind of where this whole direction is headed here. But I'd like to start off by kind of highlighting this article I was reading that you wrote back in the beginning of 2023. And you thought that best case scenario that we were going to get a soft landing and no recession. So when we add that to the inflation fade, the stock market going up, and the fact that the economy grew, doesn't this paint a picture of an environment that isn't necessarily one that would lead gold to be at all-time highs at this point?
Right. I think gold is telling us a story here by breaking out. And it's dovetailing in with my thesis that we're not going to get a soft landing, that we're going to get a hard landing. And the U.S. economy, in my opinion, cannot handle a hard landing. Mm-hmm. And I become increasingly bearish on the economy, increasingly bullish on gold, not so much talking my book, but just looking at the overall macro fundamentals of where we're at and where we're going and what the probabilities of those outcomes. Mm-hmm. So gold basically broke out in late March. And once it got above 2050, it ran for a month, and now we're about 5 weeks into this run. It went all the way up to 2400, and then it corrected this week. And everybody was talking about, okay, we are going to get a correction, but today gold has bounced. It's up $35 spot right now, back above 2300. I mean, a significant bounce. I mean, $35 instead of going lower and lower. I do think we are the cycle low. This isn't the cycle low. We are going to go a little bit lower, but I've been increasingly bullish on gold. I think we're going to get higher lows and higher highs, and I think gold is telling the story. Gold is leading here. I give Michael Oliver some kudos. He basically said that gold's leading. This is it kind of thing, the John Toll thing. And I think he's definitely right about that. I think gold's leading and gold is going to pull everything else up. Mm-hmm. So the miners haven't came along for the ride yet. I mean, the miners today were up 6 points, was good, but the HUI is at 264, which is not great. So the miners are lagging quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But silver has broken out in April this month. And I put a chart up on Twitter yesterday showing that I think 25 is about as low as silver is going to go here. And silver bounced today. It was up 47 cents the last time I checked. It's a pretty good move off of that correction on Monday and Tuesday. And so the gold and silver are kind of leading here. And I think it all dovetails into the economy and the risk on trade, which I think is coming to an end here, pivoting to risk off. And we can talk about why I think the economy is in trouble here.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to go, Don. Like, why now is there a shift away from risk on assets?
Because of the high rates. I always get into these very long dissertations about what's happened in history. Mm-hmm. And I like to go from 1980 forward. Sometimes I go back to 1970. And I give these long dissertations of, kind of why things are happening today. This has been building for decades. The U.S. economy has literally been dependent on debt since the 1980s.
If I can just interject there, I'm sure you can tie the von Mises bubble into this, right?
Yeah, I talk about von Mises all the time, saying that he's right. He basically, what he says is that there's only two ways that once you create a bubble, an economic bubble using debt, there's only two ways out. One, you pay it off, and two, it pops. And clearly, we're not going to pay it off. So yeah, the von Mises bubble is popping right now. I think it's popping this year. But to go back to this idea of it all starting in 1980, living off of debt, we've been able to get away with it because we're the reserve currency. So we've been exporting our debt and running these deficits in globalization. It kind of went hand in hand. You know, we went to globalization where we basically told our corporations, go build your products overseas and then import them back in. We'll run a trade deficit and we'll export our bonds. And so we've been exporting our debt. But when you do that, it's a kind of a doom loop because what you're doing is you're exporting inflation. Mm-hmm. And countries at a certain point, they basically tire of it. And I think that's where we're at today. And when you're exporting inflation, these countries are in a net lose situation because, you know, they keep buying these bonds, which keep going down in value. And so their reserves go down in value. And it's inflationary for them as well, because a lot of things are priced in dollars. So if dollars are going down, then they're paying more for oil, for instance. It works to a certain, eventually it always dies. They call it Triffin's dilemma. Eventually it comes to an end. And I think it's basically, we're there. And so that's the reason why gold, I think, is basically breaking out here and trending higher, because you're seeing this paradigm shift globally. And Wall Street wants to believe that this is a standard business cycle. America is still in this dominant position because, I mean, if you look at our GDP, it's 25% of global economy. So you get confused into believing that the U.S. economy is this massive economy, strong economy that's kind of dominating the global economy, when in actuality, it's a house of cards. And the reason why it's a house of cards is because of our dependency on debt and our dependency on the dollar reserve maintaining itself and our dependency on people buying our bonds. And so we're getting to the end of that road. So Janet Yellen this week, I mean, it's incredible what's happening right now. Everything's kind of come to a head. So Janet Yellen this week said that in Q3, that the Treasury Department is going to borrow almost $850 billion in a quarter. That's $280 billion a month. So that's Q3. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at Q3 at $280 billion a month of borrowing. Where are those people going to come from? Then if the recession begins in Q3, and I think it's going to, that 280 will actually expand, because state governments, they can literally demand money from the federal government. There's nothing the federal government can do to say no. It's built into the system. So whenever you have a recession, the federal deficit expands. And the reason why it expands is because states basically say, I need more money, I need more money. And they have to give it to them, the unemployment. Basically, the government, it's kind of a quasi-partnership on some of this funding. And so if the funding goes up at the state level, it also goes up on the federal level. So recessions are expansionary for the deficit. So if you get to Q3, we're at 280, it's going to expand. And then you go to Q4, and if the deficit is, I mean, if the recession is kicking really into gear there, then it expands. And so if you're at $250 billion, $300 billion, a month of trying to borrow, you basically get into this doom loop. And then the other factor And the thing that's amazing is that this is all new. This is historic stuff. This isn't stuff that's happened before ever. This is all brand new stuff. Mm-hmm. We're in this period right now, what's called fiscal dominance. What that means is that we are, the economy is dependent on government fiscal spending, the deficits. They're dependent on that. So right now we have a deficit of about $1.5 trillion. That government spending goes into GDP. So GDP right now, the last quarter was 1.6%. If the deficit was under $1 trillion, we would be in a recession right now. Mm-hmm. So if they cut spending, and especially we're going into a recession. So if you go into recession and they cut spending, then the recession's worse. And if they increase spending, then the auctions become problematic because then they have to borrow more money. So it's basically a doom loop where there's nothing they can do. They can't spend more and they can't spend less. And there's no sweet spot either. It's like where they're at, they're basically trapped. At which direction do we go? Do we spend more to increase the economy? If we spend less, what do we do? And so I've been saying this for a few months now, that the Fed is literally trapped, and the Treasury, because there's nothing the Fed can do to prevent the recession that's coming. And there's nothing they can do to get out of the recession once it begins. And the U.S. economy cannot afford a recession because we're over leveraged. We're already seeing basically, I don't know, half of America having issues with the cost of living. And that is not going to decrease. There's not going to be any costs that go down. The costs are actually going to stay where they're at, which is already squeezing budgets, and costs are going to go up. So it's going to get, what I've been saying is that the problems are going to start stacking on top of each other. It's going to be one problem after another once this recession starts to bite. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have unemployment start to raise. Today was probably, and I've been saying this, the economy is weakening. Today, they had one of the worst prints that they've had probably, I don't know, a long time for jobs. They basically said that, you know, job growth is kind of going away right now. The next, I think April's job numbers are going to be nasty. And so we're starting to see this. We're starting to see this breakdown in jobs. And then the other thing, the biting, these high interest rates are starting to bite. The combination of high interest rates and higher cost of living is starting to bite the consumer. Starbucks today came out with a really ugly number, and we're going to see more of that. And so gold's going up because of this risk and this paradigm change, and the economy is going down. So it's kind of a perfect scenario for gold and silver, but it's more than that. This is a paradigm shift for the U.S. And I write about this in my newsletter this week, is that once the money printer begins to break, now the money printer is when the Fed can print whatever they want. They don't have to think about it. Like in 2020, they printed what, $4 trillion. They didn't even think about it. They just did it. There was no question. Mm-hmm. There was nothing to push back. Well, I believe by the end of this year, Q4, they're actually going to have to go to Congress and say, look, there's a problem here. We can't borrow this as much. We know how much money we need. We can't borrow it. And that's the money printer breaking. The money printer breaking, starting to break. It won't break in 24. It'll start to break. But once you can't print what you need, bad things begin. And that's what's coming. And once it starts, it's going to be, it's that rug pull thing. It's like, the federal government is going to have no choice but to start cutting spending. And when they do that, they're going to rug pull certain people. Be right? Because that's how government spending works. And when they start rug pulling, it's going to pull the economy down further. So that's why I've been saying that when this recession starts, you're not going to be able to get out of it because of this. They can't do what they did in 2020 again. Mm-hmm. They can't reignite the liquidity. They can't do the stimulus checks because of inflation. So MMT is basically coming around to bite us, where MMT is this idea that debt doesn't matter. We can print whatever we need. Telling you, it's not going to happen. It's basically the old George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, voodoo economics, finally showing its face. Mm-hmm. Voodoo economics is finally here. And what Bush was insinuating was that you there's no free lunch. You can't expand debt. This is back to the von Mises bubble. You can't expand debt and expect there not to be reverberations at a certain point. That's the voodoo economics. You're just asking for it. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. has been asking for it for 30 years. And so I've been saying that the fear level in 2024 is going to exceed 2008. And the reason why is because in 2008, the Fed had a lot of options. They don't have any options this time, and everybody's going to know it.
So, Don, why is this time different?
Well, I've been explaining why it's different. What's different is that the Fed does not have the tools to pull us out of this situation. And the other thing that's different is the U.S. economy in the 1990s was generating, we were using debt, but we actually balanced the budget at the end of the decade. But we were kind of a dynamic economy in the 90s where we definitely did have growth. We actually did have real growth. And you know, that you had this expansion in technology. In the 1990s, the U.S. was standing on its own feet, if you will, even though we were still using debt to a certain extent, especially in the beginning of the 90s. But the second half of the 90s, we weren't. We were literally standing on our 2 feet. And that was the last hurrah of the U.S. economy. That was when in 1998, before the dot-com bubble bursted, 99, that was the U.S. economy at its height. And then we get to 2000, and then the dot-com bubble pops, and then we have a recession, and then 2001 hits, and then that leads us into the great financial recession. And so it was basically this century has just been a nightmare for the U.S. economy. So that's what's different, is that we have literally been on a downward spiral now for 25 years, and it's basically now starting to hit us. And like I said earlier about how we've been exporting bonds and exporting inflation and the rest of the world is tired of it, that's a massive paradigm shift. So what we've been trying to do since 1980 with globalism and Keynesian economics and exporting bonds, that's no longer going to work. So where the U.S. government's going to rug pull people when they have to cut the budget, the rest of the world is going to rug pull us as well, because they're going to stop buying our bonds and they're going to start dumping our equities. Mm-hmm. And when they do that, they're going to put downward pressure on the dollar. And as the dollar goes down, gold will go up. And so that's the reason why this time is different. But it's even more than that. We could go on and on.
Absolutely. Don, you know, when you're talking about the rest of the world dumping U.S. bonds, could Japan's currency and bond battle right now spark a crisis in these markets as well because of, you know, this dynamic that they have to sell the treasury, the U.S. treasuries that they have, in order to raise the capital to support their currency / bond market?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually tweeted about this yesterday. So Japan, going back to the 1990s, every time they try something, they don't give up easily. They're very stubborn people. Mm-hmm. And they have this concept in Asia called losing face. And so if you try something, you own it, kind of thing, right? And so they don't turn on a dime. They basically, if they try something, they usually do it a few times before they change their mind. They have to let it run its course, if you will. I mean, we saw this in the early 1990s where they would do infrastructure spending. They do one bill after another. And they did that for like 5 years in a row. And it never worked. but they couldn't give up. They had to show, you know, that, you know, we got to try that. We say we're going to try it. We're going to try it. You know, and they're not going
to show that it really doesn't work.
Yeah, that's the Japanese way. And so now that they have this problem with the yen, and so they've shown their cards. Their cards are they're going to sell treasuries to boost their yen. So we know the game plan, Ryan. Right. So if the yen keeps going up, they're going to be selling treasuries. We just know that's going to happen until they decide to do something different. So they got $1 trillion in treasuries, so they could sell. They could be selling for the next 6 months, which would put downward pressure on the dollar for sure. Mm. The other thing they can do is raise rates, which they don't want to do, but they have been doing it. So if you look at the 10-year, it was like at zero, and now it's almost a 1%. So they have been raising rates. So that is another thing that they're going to keep doing. The 10-year is going to go higher, and then the short-term rates were literally at zero. And they've taken the short-term rates up a little bit, like 0.1, right? So we are going to see rates go up a little bit more in Japan, which hurts their carry trade. And we're going to see them dumping dollars. That's going to happen. Now, one interesting thing about Japan that I think is a theory, I think it might be false, but Jim Willey brought it up. First time I heard anybody say it. And basically what he says is that Japan has started buying gold because they realize that dumping bonds doesn't work. Now, I don't know if they're actually buying gold. I don't know if they can hide that from us. But one thing that would be really interesting is that selling bonds and buying gold. Now, that would be a really interesting scenario if they start doing that. Now, the other thing we've been hearing is that South Korea is buying gold. Singapore's buying gold, you know, so these Asian countries are starting to buy gold. Now, if you have China hoarding gold, South Korea, if South Korea starts buying gold, I guarantee you Japan's going to jump in and buy gold too, because that's how it works. If that's Japan's two number one competitors, right? They're not going to let South Korea and China buy a whole bunch of gold and they're sitting there with none. Mm-hmm. So that's a real interesting dynamic. You know, the Asian countries start buying more gold. Now, the one thing, and Luke Groman has basically been all over this, is this idea that because of interest rates, bonds, basically interest rates going up and U.S. bonds going down, bonds are losing their value. So bonds don't buy as much oil as gold does. Gold buys more oil because gold's been going up. Bonds down, gold up. So now gold actually starts having this really important dynamic for these countries as far as reserves go. Because if you have to buy a lot of oil, Japan imports oil, China imports oil. So if you're buying oil and your reserves are in bonds, that's not a good combo. And that's kind of what Luke's been saying, is that's why they're going to dump bonds and buy gold, because gold buys more oil. The thesis really holds water when you think about it. Mm-hmm. So,
especially for a country like Japan that is so dependent on importing much of their energy. Oil.
Yeah. Makes sense. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting too, kind of the way you said that about, you know, these Asian countries in some ways competing for gold. I had a recent interview that the guest was speaking about when countries start panic buying gold.
That'd be nice.
You know, in a way you could see how the mechanics of that start to happen. Possibly.
I thought it was actually happening in China. Mm-hmm. Because it was a really interesting dynamic. I mean, I don't know how many months ago it began, but it's been a recent phenomenon. The Shanghai Exchange had a 1-2% premium on gold. Mm-hmm. And so the Shanghai market was starting to impact, if you will, the price of gold because of these premiums. And then in right around March 20th, the breakout in gold at 2060 happened in Shanghai. if you looked at the Shanghai open and close, it was just on the daily. If you go back and look at the daily on the Shanghai, starting right around March 20th, you just basically had these big green candles every single day for like 2 weeks. It was crazy. And they literally took over the price of gold. Shanghai literally took it over and just had these green candles, boom, 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 all the way up to $2,400. And I thought, China, oh, wow, China's taken over this thing. But once it got to 2,400, a lot of times you don't get a real good, clear picture of it because something else comes into play. Now, the thing that came into play on this run, this gold run, was Israel and Iran. And those happened on weekends, and the big Shanghai moves were on Sunday nights. So it was like, it was really hard to get a feel for the final move from like 2,300 to 2,400. Was that final move because of Iran, Israel? Mm-hmm. We don't know. And then once that Israel, Iran, once it concluded, it turned out to be a nothing burger. The price of gold went down. And then China stopped buying. So that run from the 20th, it basically stopped their first week, last week of April, that run stopped. We stopped getting those big moves, daily moves, and gold started going down in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the move today in gold outpaced Shanghai, I think that's a really good sign. I mean, if you look at the Shanghai close last night, gold is up significantly off of the Shanghai close. Mm-hmm. That we haven't been seeing that. What we've been seeing is the Shanghai goes and then the U.S. matches it or holds it, but it doesn't really outperform it. Mm-hmm. So for gold to outperform Shanghai today, maybe Shanghai will get, start holding up the gold market. But it's also happening in Shanghai and silver as well. I mean, this is the first time that I've really ever followed Shanghai. Every night now, I basically go and check the Shanghai market, what it's doing. Mm-hmm. Because I think the Shanghai right now is taking over pricing of gold and silver to a large extent. And that New York is starting to play second fiddle here. So if we're looking for the floor in gold and silver, I think gold's going to lead here, so I think that's the important one to look at. I mean, if you look at the gold chart, it broke out at 2050, and so that's the reason why my range is from 2000 to 2200. And 2000 has really, really strong support. So I do not expect 2000 to break down. Gary Savage actually tweeted yesterday, it's not going to happen. I mean, he's like 99% confident that 2000, we're not going below that. Mm-hmm. But his cycle low is 2150, which I think has a really good chance of holding here. So I'm thinking that the breakout was like at 2050, 2060, where you had that big green candle. So I'm thinking that it's probably going to be somewhere 2050 to 2150. That range is what we can look for the cycle low. And if anything above 2150 is a gift. And so if that's as low as gold is going to go in this cycle low, and again, I don't think to this cycle, what's happening in the pricing right now, I don't think that's it. I think we're going to get another correction. Mm-hmm. So we bounced today. So we got the whole month of May, basically. And it could even happen in the summertime when we get a cycle low. But I do not, I think this is, the thing that's significant here is that the higher low, the last higher low was 1810 back in October. So we're jumping $200, which is significant. And we might be jumping, $300, $350 off of that cycle low. I think it was 1810. So that's a really nice move. And then basically higher lows. And so we could really bounce this year. We could really bounce significantly off of that cycle low. I mean, he's thinking 2,700 to 3,000 is kind of his target for the year. Mm-hmm. And if these levels hold, but I think we're definitely going to go north of 2,500 here, if 2,150 holds, it just feels like gold's ready to really make a big move this year. My target for the year was 2,400, but that seems to be very too conservative. Mm-hmm. And my target for silver is 40. I still think 40 is a good number. I don't think we're going to get to 50 this year, but I mean, it's a possibility. But we're looking at some really big moves here in gold and silver. Depending, now I think the S&P is getting ready to roll over here. Wall Street is hoping that 4,800 holds. Now, they were hoping back in October that the 200-day moving average held, and it did. It went and touched it, and it held. Now they're hoping it holds again. I don't think it's going to happen this time, because the reason why it held back in October is because the economy had not weakened enough. Mm-hmm. You still had strong earnings. You still had people employed. Everything was somewhat strong back in October. I don't think we have that today. So I don't think the 200 is going to hold. I think it's going to bleed all the way down to sub 4,000 on the S&P by the end of the year. And then next year, I think it's going to get even worse. I think we're looking at 3,000 to 3,500 next year before we basically find a bottom. And then I just think it's going to be a slow bleed from here for the next 12 months. And then once we get that bottom, I think we turn Japanese and just muddle for about 3 years, and it's going to get pretty ugly.
Don, as you're talking about your silver target, what do you expect from silver in this bull market? You know, is it now less of a monetary metal and more of an industrial commodity?
As we speak right now, yes. Mm-hmm. But silver is gold's proxy. And once gold basically becomes a go-to asset. So if you look at Exeter's pyramid, gold at the very tip, which is basically, you know, the least risky asset to hold. The only reason why people go to gold is if they have to, because it doesn't pay income. Like, you know, Warren Buffett always says, I don't want old gold. It doesn't pay me anything. Mm-hmm. So you only go to gold if you have to. It's a place to hide, if you will. And so the only reason why you would do that is if stocks and bonds basically are not a good place to hide. Now, historically, people have been able to hide in currencies, fiat, or bonds. Now, if you were sitting in fiat in a checking account, you lost, and you had $1 million in your checking account, now it's worth $750,000. You lost $250,000. Wasn't a great place to hide. Simultaneously, that gold went up. So now people are saying, uh-oh, where do I go? Now, you could use money market funds, and that's work. But I think interest rates are going to come down in short term. I think short term rates are going to come down. So it's going to be tough to monitor. You know, checking accounts are definitely not going to work, but money markets might not work either. And then I think bonds are actually going to lose value over the next 3 years, because I think interest rates are going to go up as the bond market becomes problematic. So as gold goes up, at a certain point, it becomes a go-to asset where more and more people are running to gold. Well, once that happens, silver becomes a proxy. And once silver becomes a proxy to gold, then it also becomes a monetary metal. It becomes a place where you go to hide. And so who's going to buy silver? The people who are going to buy silver is basically your middle class who can't afford gold. Mm-hmm. How many people can afford $2,500 for a 1 ounce coin? Not that many have $2,500 to go buy it. But what they do have is they have $500 or $200 a month where they can go buy some silver. So more and more people will be buying silver as a proxy. And once that happens, that's why you get the squeeze. Mm-hmm. The GSR, it's always going to squeeze once you get that proxy situation in effect. And so, you know, my target GSR is 30. And people think, well, Don, that's too aggressive. Well, we got to 39 in 2011. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even a significant proxy situation. It wasn't even a situation yet where people were running to gold. And it still got to 39. So if it got to 39 under those conditions, do you really think it's not going to get to 30 if gold suddenly is a go-to metal? Of course it's going to go to 30. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, I'm not aggressive enough. A lot of people think it's going to go to 15, which would be in kind of crazy land. Mm-hmm. Because silver goes to 13 or 15 and gold goes to 3,500. You do the math on that. Silver prices go absolutely bonkers. Mm-hmm. So it gets pretty, pretty interesting. Now the one thing is I want to mention, follow up there on kind of my price targets on silver. I did a chart. I think I mentioned this already in the interview. I did a chart where if you draw a line on silver over the last 3 years, it really looks like $25 is going to hold here on this correction. Mm-hmm. And if gold is holding its price, there's a good chance 25 holds. So if 25 holds, you could bounce over $30 here fairly quickly. And once you get above $30 on silver, so we just retested 30. I mean, we went up to 29.80, I think. So we got really close to testing 30. So I think the next time it goes through it like butter and we go to like $32. And once that happens, the floor on silver goes from 25 to 28, which is amazing because that... I think that is exactly what's going to happen because 28 is really the support line, which we did. We went up and it didn't hold, and we went back. We went through it like butter. From once we got above 28, it just didn't hold at all. But next time we get above it, I think 28 will be once you get above 30. Once you get above 32, let's say, I think 28 is the new floor. Mm-hmm. And once 28 is the new floor, you're basically looking at an all time high now. Silver in 2011 was at $49. Now, if you adjust $49 from 2011, inflation adjusted, it comes out to 67. I firmly believe the target for silver on the next run is not 50, which would be a nominal high. It's 67. That's the target.
The inflation adjusted.
Yeah, look for 67. That should be your target. We're going to 67 is my point. Now, maybe it doesn't hold and then we roll back all the way down in the 40s. That could happen. But I definitely expect to see 67. I would maybe not in 12 months, but within 24 months, I expect to see 67. Mm-hmm.
So, Don, when we think about, who you were saying is going to be buying silver, my mind goes back to the Hunt brothers. And the fact that they wanted to kind of corner the silver market. Do you think we could see another 80s style silver squeeze if somebody comes in and recognize that there is tightness in this market and that they do want to, create a short squeeze like that?
Yeah. So this gets into all types of theories of what can push gold or silver higher. And most people, they're like, okay, they're just theories, Don. There's a bunch of baloney. A bunch of BS. Mm-hmm. I'll go back to, I'm going to answer that question. I'm going to go back to the real fundamentals of silver and I'm glad we talked about this, how silver becomes a proxy for gold and it turns into a monetary metal. So in that scenario, the only thing that really matters is how high gold goes. Mm-hmm. So, my target for gold has been 3,000, which is, I think, that's what the number I've been using since 2012 when I started my website. 3,000 now looks like a hop, skip, and a jump, right? We were just at $2,400. That's a 25% move. Mm-hmm. So silver, gold, I think, is going to 3,500. So if you just from the monetary metal alone standpoint, if you take 3,500 and you divide by 30, you're well over $100. Mm-hmm. That's just foundational stuff, right? There's no conspiracy theories there. There's no Hunt brothers. That's just foundational data. Mm-hmm. Where the odds are in your favor if you own physical silver. Now let's look at some of these outcomes that that occur that could light a fire under silver that has nothing to do with the monetary aspect. Now, for me, number one is somewhat related to what you're saying about somebody going in there and trying to corner the market. One billionaire just basically saying, you know what? There's not very much silver left on COMEX. I'm going to go buy it all. And if I buy it all, I'm probably going to double my money. Right? And he probably is going to double his money. He's not
as long as it's managed properly.
He's not going to make the mistake of the Hunt brothers. The Hunt brothers used margin. They did not acquire physical silver. They used margin. That's how they did it. They were basically using the futures market. They were controlling all this silver. They were not hoarding physical. So I think that there's a chance that, you know, one billionaire basically says, look, I'm going to go and I'm just going to buy it up and see what happens. And my target price is $100 silver. So if I buy it up at 50 bucks, you know, I'm going to double my money anyway. And if things go crazy, I might triple my money or double, you know, triple it. Mm-hmm. And so that whole Hunt Brothers scenario is in play here. That's number one. Number two is I just don't think there's a lot of 1,000-ounce bars in inventory for sale right now. Now, what we're seeing over the last 3 years, and you could go back to 2021, is we are seeing there's only really three exchanges in the world that have significant inventory. You got COMEX in the U.S., then you have the LBMA in London, and then you have Shanghai. Those are the three futures markets where you can buy, you can take possession of large quantities of 1,000-ounce bars. Mm-hmm. Those are really the only ones other than the wholesalers, the bullion banks. And the bullion banks, over the last 3 years, we have seen an amazing amount of deficit silver. So it was in 2022, it was like 150 million ounces. 2023, it was like over 200, 190, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then this year, they're saying that it's going to be around 250. So over the last 3 years, we've been averaging 200 million ounces of deficits. All of that silver has to come from above ground sources. And what we're seeing is that these three exchanges, their levels keep dropping. And the big one, the one that's been dropping the most dramatically, is China. And I think the reason why is because China is the one that needs all the silver to build stuff like phones or solar panels, mm-hmm. cars. They've been building a ton of electric cars, right? So their inventory in 2021 was 3,000 tons. Today, it's 850 to 870, and it went down 200 tons in April. Hmm. Went from 1,000 to 800-something. Dropped 200 tons in 1 month. So if it drops 100 tons a month over the next 5 months, they're pretty much out of silver. They basically, I mean, that. So the inventories are dropping. So I don't think there's a lot of 1,000-ounce bars out there. Well,
and you have to imagine their incentive price to get silver once that situation really starts to materialize is going to increase dramatically. And I think another source, which I wanted to get your take on, Don, was the idea that the ETFs have been bleeding physical metal as well. So, you know, what do you think explains that? Is that just lack of interest from Western investors?
No. You can take people are buying. They're actually buying silver off of those ETFs and taking possession. Mm-hmm. You can do that. The SLV, you can buy silver and take possessions of it, but you can only do it in large quantities.
Yeah, you have to be an authorized participant, right?
Not only an authorized participant, but you have to. It has to be like one mm-hmm. ton, 32,000 ounces. Mm-hmm. That's the minimum. And you can do the same thing with gold, but it has to be large quantities. So people like me and you can't do it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why these ETFs are shrinking, because people are basically they're going wherever they can find it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the ETFs will slowly kind of drain out as well. But I want to go back to this idea of inventory shortages driving the prices up. So what I think is going to happen Like right now, you have people, they've been talking about this, that they're saying that coin dealers and websites like AppMex, they're getting too many people are selling their silver back to them and they're not buying it. Nobody wants to buy any silver. And the coin dealers are basically turning people away, saying, I don't want any more silver. I don't need any. Go see you later. They're literally turning people away. Well, because there's no buyers.
You can tell that because of the premiums
going down.
Exactly.
Right. But I think this is a total misnomer because what's going to happen, silver is a very strange asset. It becomes more, demand goes up as silver prices go up. Mm-hmm. It's the exact opposite. And so once silver gets to $35, a perfect example is the 1980s and in 2011, people come out of the woodwork to buy this stuff when it's over $40. They had line in the 1980s. You have people lining around the block to buy this stuff. Mm-hmm. They didn't care about it when it was at $5. When it was at $40, they're all lining up. Mm-hmm. That's how silver works, and the reason why it's a proxy for gold. And when gold's going up, I got to buy something. I want to buy silver. So when the proxy kicks in, that's when the buyers show up. Mm-hmm. So it's not a proxy today. So the premiums are dying. But when your silver gets to $35 and the proxy correlation kicks in, that's when the retail crowd shows up and they're going to start emptying out the coin dealers and they're going to start emptying out the websites. And once you cannot, and so the 5 ounce and the 10 ounce and the 100 ounce bars, those are all made from 1,000 ounce bars. 1,000 ounce bars, and there's no such thing as a 1,000 ounce bar, by the way. They basically create these big bricks and they're close to 1,000 ounces. Mm-hmm. But none of them are 1,000 ounce on the button. They're just, it's too hard to do. So they're like, 1,001 ounce, they're close, but but basically those are what they use to make stuff with. And so if they run out of 5 ounce, 10 ounce, 100 ounce bars on these websites, the refiners are going to go buy a bunch of 1,000 ounce bars and make them. They're going to, right? And so they're going to suck the 1,000 ounce bars away as well. And so those refiners are going to take inventory away from the fabricators. And that's where you get your shortage. Because the refiners are all going to be start buying a whole bunch of inventory and the fabricators are going to go, they're going to be fighting. They're basically going to be fighting over the dregs, the last bars that are available, and you're going to run out. And once, I think that's the scenario that's going to play out here, that before you get to $50 silver, I think you're going to see shortages in 1,000 ounce bars. And once that happens, silver will shoot to 67 really quickly. Mm-hmm. That's my thesis.
So Don, as another, let's say, proxy for gold or physical silver, do you think that the gold miners bull market is still on hold at this point?
Well, it kind of is. However, another thing I tweeted yesterday was, if you look at the HUI, I use the HUI as my indicator when to buy and when to sell, when miners are cheap and when they're not. Mm-hmm. And I basically gave a chart yesterday and I showed how I do it. So anything above the HUI is currently about 269. Now I use 250 as my neutral level. So anything below 250 is kind of, you're looking for, you can buy cheap stocks. So anything from, and I'll go to the bottom. So below 200 on the HUI is a load the truck scenario. It's rare. It's rare for the HUI to be under 200. Now, anything between 200 and 225 is my buy zone. Mm-hmm. That's when I want to buy. Anytime it's below that, I'm looking for stocks that are on sale. And then from 225 to 250 is your opportunity zone. But not everything's cheap, but there are opportunities. There's absolutely opportunities in that opportunity zone. So we left the opportunity zone And now we're at 269. So from 250 to 275, that is when the opportunities are starting to go away, but they're still there. You can still find them. Mm-hmm. And then from 275 to 300, that is your last, that's the last chance. So we're getting, we're still, and the bull market hasn't started in these miners, but we're getting to the point where you're almost a last chance place. 275 to 300 is kind of the last chance to find stocks that are cheap. Then once above 300, cheap stocks are disappearing left and right. Mm-hmm. They're basically just, that's the disappearing zone. But we are still in sub 300, sub 275. We're still in that area where you can find stocks that are cheap. Like, I still think all the Mormons are cheap. I've been typing a lot about those. And those are kind of the, I call them the pretty girls. That's where you want to marry multiple stocks. And so those stocks are still cheap. But once you get above 300, I think the Mormons are all going to, most of the Mormons are going to be, you know, you kind of miss the boat. And then once you're above 350 on the HUI, that's when the bull market resumes. And I think it's going to this year. Mm-hmm. So we have about 2 months, 3 months, you know, ballpark guess of being able to find stocks that are cheap. And then once you, you know, once you get above 325, 330 on the HUI, it's like bye-bye, baby. You missed the party. Mm-hmm.
Two points there, Don. You know, don't you think that your target of 3 months, that takes us into the end of July or end of July from right now when we're speaking. So does that not take us right into the middle of the summer doldrums where not really anybody cares and not much happens in the gold industry?
The last big run in gold and silver was in the summer of 2020. Mm-hmm. It occurred in May, June, July. So one of the biggest runs in gold and silver happened in July, the whole month of July. Mm-hmm. So summer doldrums, this year don't expect it to happen. Because mm-hmm. once you get this bifurcation or pivot from risk on to risk off, gold and silver stocks could move very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And once the HUI gets above 275, you could blink and be at 300. Now, that said, I do believe, I said earlier that I think we're going to have another dip down in gold and silver. This dip that we just had, I don't think it's the final one. Mm-hmm. I think we will get one more cycle low. I think the cycle low is coming. I'm hoping it happens in May. And so when that happens, we don't know how quickly the bounce will happen. It's possible it could take 2 months for it to bounce. I mean, it could get stuck down there. Mm-hmm. You could get this where the when the pivot from the when the fear trade kicks in, you're going to see selling pressure on gold, selling pressure on the miners, and that selling pressure could last longer than we want it to. Now, I'm hoping the selling pressure lasts 2 weeks and then boom, we're off and running. Mm-hmm. But it's possible you could get, you know, some severe selling pressure and the HUI could go all the way back down to, say, 230. I don't think it'll go below 230. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping 250 holds, but I would say somewhere, you know, it's at 269 right now. I think we could see, you know, 230, 250 on the final correction. That the bounce comes quickly, if you will. We don't get stuck, you know, around 250 for, you know, a couple months. Mm-hmm. That would be ugly. You know, we're sitting here waiting, you know, waiting for Godot kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But this is a very pivotal year. The next couple of months are very pivotal. We've been in we get to August, that's a 4-year correction. 4 years. So we've been in, you know, we're getting coming in on a 4-year correction in gold, silver miners. Mm-hmm. So I think it's ending here. I think it is ending this year. And we have potential for the rest of this year to be really good for gold, silver miners. And then next year, even better.
Mm-hmm. So Don, do you think that maybe, you know, if we get back to that 350 level on the HUI, that's where Wall Street maybe gets interested in buying miners?
Yes, they will get interested before that, I believe. It basically all comes down to this idea of risk on versus risk off. Is Wall Street comfortable? You know, I saw a bull this week on the halftime show say that his S&P target for the year is 5,100, and he's a bull. So, I mean, glaring bull. I mean, this, you know, he basically loves being fully invested in his target, 5,100. We're at 5,100 today. So Wall Street is ready to give up on stocks, I think. Give up on having so much allocation in stocks. They're ready to pivot into some of these miners. Now, not all of them, but we only need about 10%. You know, if 10% decide they want to buy some Newmont and Barrick, and I think we're on the precipice of that. And I was screaming when Newmont got to $29, I was screaming that it was a bottom. That if you buy Newmont at $29, your risk reward is outstanding. Because my target's 150 to 170, and you're buying at $30, $29. My goodness, how much lower can Newmont go if gold prices don't go down? If gold prices go up? And all you have to do is hold Newmont, just hold it. I mean, you buy it at 29, it's not going bankrupt. You just hold that thing until gold goes up. And guess what? Wall Street didn't buy it. When it went to 29, from 32 to 29, that was the final sell-off in February. There was no volume. There were sellers, there was no buyers. It was crazy. Like, what is Wall Street thinking here? The only person that bought it was Druckenmiller. He was the only guy. He came out and said, I bought Newmont and Barrick. He's the only smart guy on Wall Street. I mean, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're going to be buying Newmont at 60. That's when they'll buy it, after it doubles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing that's crazy is that's 100% return on Newmont, whereas they're absolutely in love with getting a 20% return on Apple.
Yeah,
20%. They're going crazy on a 20% return on Apple, and they could get 100% return on Newmont. They don't want to even touch it. Yeah, mm-hmm. So once we get above 300, I think on the HY, I think you'll see Wall Street pushing Newmont and Barrick up. I think Newmont, I think it'll run to $50 fairly quickly. It got to 43. I don't know what it's trading at this week. Went from 29 to 43 fairly quickly, but I think it'll get to 50 fairly quickly here once the pivot happens. And then once that pivot happens, I mean, I told somebody that I thought it'd be up 100%, so I'd be at 58 or 65, you know, by the end of summer, and or even 80 by the end of summer.
What do you mean by the pivot, Don, just to make that a little bit more clear for those that are confused by that?
Yeah. So we've been in a risk on market since 2009. And risk on is basically when you're overweight stocks and you're comfortable, because stocks are risky assets. You don't know how they're going to perform. Mm-hmm. And so if you're overweight stocks, you're basically, that's basically considered a risk on trade. And when you're balanced or underweight stocks, you're more risk off. And so the pivot is from overweight stocks, risk on, to basically back the balance or underweight stocks, which would be a risk off event. And also in risk off, you just have more and more people that are basically, you know, have risk off portfolios. They have more bonds, they have more cash, more utilities, and, you know, defensive. Go to risk off is basically a defensive strategy, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so that's the pivot. The pivot is away from aggressive risk on to more defensive risk off. That's the pivot. And I think we're right on the precipice of that. And once that happens, that's when your miners get a bid. And
so that's the Wall Street pivot.
Yes. So Wall Street pivot, you need the big money. You got to have big money to get everybody interested in these things. More volume. I mean, if you look at the market cap for all the gold stocks or all the silver stocks, it's minuscule, because none of the big money is in there. They've all basically ran. They ran from the miners. And so the money starts coming back in, the big money on Wall Street. So, you know, the HUI is basically the big money. But it's an indicator. If the HUI is doing well, usually all the other stocks are doing well as also mm-hmm. doing better. They outperform the HUI. But you need the HUI to lead. That's just the way that it works. You need money to come into the sector. I mean, we need to double it, right? We need to 2x the market caps of these things. We need to go up 100%. In tandem with this pivot thing, this risk on risk off, the other thing that you need is you need sentiment. So sentiment has been dead in the miners since 2013. Mm-hmm. And sentiment is when you basically go to a guy and say, you know, I want to buy a mining stock. And they say, no, and it doesn't. And they're like, get out of my office. Mm-hmm. That's when sentiment is totally dead. Where somebody comes in and said, you know, I saw a gold miner. Then they say, sit down, let's talk. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the difference. Right now, Wall Street is, I mean, 6 months ago, Wall Street office, right? There's some kid and he's doing some analysis and he walks into his boss's office and he says, look, this miner looks great. His boss is basically, get out of here, man. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? Go back there and analyze Apple. But now that kid comes into the office, he'll go, what's the name? That's the pivot.
Mm-hmm. So Don, you know, there's several different classes of miners. Where do you feel like the class is, or is there a rule that provides, let's say, the best risk profile versus possible return? Is it in developers? Is it in, you know, miners that have steady cash flow, or is it in some of these drill stories?
Yeah. So I'm basically an expert in this area. I've been doing this for 20 years and I've learned. So the worst risk reward by far is your exploration stocks. I've had terrible luck in explorers. Mm-hmm. In my career, I probably break even. Now, I just think that I do explorers primarily for fun, if you will. The only way that you do good on exploration stocks, because the risk reward is so terrible, and I'll explain why, is the only way you really do well is that you get a position in a kind of a early, you get in really early, you get a position. Mm-hmm. And basically you talk to the company and you talk to somebody that knows about the company. It's not illegal insider information, but you have more information than the average investor. Mm-hmm. You got a feel for that deposit. And so that's why you're in early, but it's still a lottery pick. So number one, you're in early and you got good info. And odds are we can't do that because it's too risky and we don't get that good info. Number two, you got to be ready to press your bet. This is why Eric Sprott does so well. So he gets in early. He usually has better information than us. And then once they get a good drill hole, he's got the cash on the back to press his bet. And so he can basically get this 20 bagger. Mm-hmm. But for us, that strategy is very, very difficult and it usually doesn't work. And, you know, if you're overweight these explorers, you're just going to get killed. If I had to start over again, I would not buy any explorers except if they were tandem optionality play and exploration. So those are the only thing I focus on now. You know, a good example is like Southern Silver. They have 350 million ounces of silver equivalent, and the silver in the ground's like valued less than 50 cents an ounce. So I get all that optionality because it's probably going to go from, you know, 30 cents an ounce to a dollar. That's a three bagger there. And then they can find more silver. So it's a drill story on top of optionality. Those are the ones I like. Okay. Now we have two other categories, developers and producers. Mm-hmm. I think by far the best risk reward is your producers, because producers can grow a variety of ways. And so, but you don't want, you know, the majors that are, you know, valued at 5 billion or month or higher, because they can't really grow. There's a few unique ones that are 5 billion to 10 billion. Mm-hmm. A few of those like Ken Ross that are kind of undervalued that you can play. And even Newmont got really cheap recently, but not so much now. So there are a few of the upper end on the producers, but really where your sweet spot is the mid tiers, that are valued somewhere between 100 million and a billion. And sometimes you can go a little higher than that, 100 million to 1.5 billion. Now, these companies, you want to make sure there's a lot of check boxes you got to check off, right? Good location, good management, good balance sheet, et cetera. You can check these boxes off. You can find the best ones. But what's the risk reward where it really comes into play is their ability to grow production, the ability to grow their company. What they can grow in three ways, where an exploration company, the only thing they can do is the drill bit, right? So at mid-tier, they can, the drill bit's one way. The other way is they can do acquisitions. So they can go out and they can find a company. And then the other way is their multiple can explode because the price of gold and silver goes up. And that's the key. That's the key one right there. Mm-hmm. So if you buy a company that's cheap and it has a multiple of like five, I'd love to buy companies, quality companies with multiples of five, because their multiple can go to 15. So you're going to get 2x growth just on the multiple expansion. And then you're going to get another 2x, 3x or more on their free cash flow growing. Mm-hmm. Because the free cash flow, every time the free cash flow goes up, their value goes up. So you grow through the multiple, through the free cash flow, through the acquisition, through the drill bit. So you got these four ways to grow through the mid-tier. Plus, a lot of these companies are solid companies that are the risk reward, you know, it just works for them. Mm-hmm. And so I want to be overweight producers because I think that's the best risk reward. Now, developers. Developers will break your heart over and over again. Now, your developers are where you get your 50 baggers. Most of your producers, you're not going to get 50 baggers, pretty rare. You're going to get 5 to 15 baggers. But if you want 20 to 50 baggers, I think developers are the way to go. I just did two YouTube videos on 50 developing stories, mm-hmm. 50, and I own 40 of them. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I own 40 of them, now I don't put as much allocation into these stocks, but more allocation into the producers. I only do like 0.25 of my overall cost basis in the developers because they're 20 to 50 baggers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got this huge upside, but you don't know which ones are going to work. That's the problem with these development stories. So many things can go wrong and they will break your heart so many times. And the number one way they break your heart is you help, as an investor, you help them pay for the construction of that mine, for the development of that mine. You get in early and you stay in and you withstand all of these financings and you get, you know, all you get diluted into the ground over and over and over again. There's probably going to be 3, 4, 5 financing before they get to construction. And then when they get to the final CapEx, they basically do a bad financing and hurt your upside. And then to put the dagger in your heart, they sell the thing 6 months before first pour or 6 months after first pour. Mm-hmm. Oh man, these things will break your heart over and over again. So don't marry these stocks. Just buy the ones that you think have the best potential and then see which ones work. You know, and trust me, 75% of the time they're going to break your heart. Mm-hmm. And so you want to be overweight these producers because those are the ones that aren't going to break your heart. Those are the ones that are going to do fabulously well for you. You know, I'll give you one example. I owned Crocodile Gold, which is a mid-tier producer, and I didn't pay very much for it. I got in really cheap. Then Kirkland Lake acquired Crocodile Gold, and then Agnico Eagle acquired Kirkland Lake. So remember I said you can grow through acquisition. You can grow through acquisitions. You can grow through free cash flow. Mm-hmm. So my cost basis on Agnico Eagle is like 550, and it's currently at, I think, 65 or something. So it's better than a 10 bagger, but mm-hmm. I invested, I think, like $7,000. And now it's well over 150,000. So you don't have to put a lot of money in because sometimes these stocks, these producers, they just keep giving. They just keep growing and growing and growing and growing. I'm not going to sell Agnico until gold gets to 3,000 or 3,500. Mm-hmm. It's paying a good dividend. So my cost basis on Agnico Eagle is zero because the dividends that they pay mm-hmm. have paid for my cost basis. So if you get a producer and it turns into a dividend player, your cost basis is going to go down, down, down. So these things can turn into, these producers can turn into beautiful investments in the long term. Because it takes a while, you know, dividends over 5 years basically add up.
So Don, you know, you hold quite a few different stocks, and I'm sure you've heard of the great taking. So what is your two cents on holding stocks and shares at this time? And do you think about how to protect them?
Yeah. So first of all, I think that I, when I got into this, I believe this was a once in a lifetime trade. In other words, I'm going to go in and then I'm going to wait until gold, until, well, let's be honest, I'm going to be accurate here. I'm going to get in, I'm going to build my portfolio up, and I'm going to wait for the US bond market to break and Eckster's pyramid to kick in. That was my thesis from day one. And so if the bond market breaks, that's a once in a lifetime thing. And so, and that's, and I started that 20 years ago. And so now I'm waiting for that scenario to unfold, which I think it's going to happen over the next 3 years. So my plan, so that's why I'm not really afraid of the great taking. I think the great taking in many respects is kind of a paranoid take, that paranoid that they're going to take your money. They're going to steal it. You know, I'm not really in that camp, because I don't think that this is, that the economy is going to crash. I think what we're going to see is basically a slowing and a lot of winners and losers, if you will. But I don't think that, you know, maybe we'll see a brokerage go under, but the way that the brokerages work, they don't own your shares. Not like a bank. You give a bank money, they own your money. You're giving them a loan. Once you give it to them, it's theirs. But if you buy a stock, the brokerage doesn't own your shares. They can't commingle that. So if a brokerage goes under, the way that it works is the regulators transfer your shares to another brokerage. So I'm not really worried about my brokerages, you know, going under per se. But what I am worried about is I don't want to hold, I don't want to wait till the top to sell everything. So for me, the defensive way to do it, one is to be very diversified. So I have 165 positions. That's about as diversified as you can get. And I have a bunch of physical silver. That's another way you diversify. And then I diversify with crypto. And a lot of people think that's not smart. Well, it's been very lucrative for me to diversify into crypto, because I got in early on crypto and I still have it. Crypto to me has been the best diversification method I could have used. Yeah, so when gold goes into these big corrections, I got this crypto over here that basically holds me up. It's like my ballast, if you will. It's like holding a lot of cash, but it goes up in value. It has tended to go up. But here's my big thesis theory on defending how you protect yourself for future problems, like what the great taking is saying. And that is sell to the top. And that's what I'm going to do. My exit strategy is to sell to the top. I'm not going to sell at the top, sell to the top. So my thesis is you buy to the bottom and you sell to the top. So when you buy to the bottom, you find a stock that's near a bottom. Like when Newmont's at 29, you start buying the hell out of that. When Coeur got down to 210, you buy the hell out of it. Endeavor got to 150, you buy the hell out of it. You buy to the bottom. So when you find these stocks that are on sale, then you buy to the bottom. But that's when you buy to the bottom, when you know they're cheap. When you know a stock is cheap, buy it to the bottom. And then buy to the top. Okay, so for me, I think that the best place to start selling the silver miners is about $65 silver. So I want to sell. I'm going to probably do a sell at 50, maybe a little at 60, but not a lot. But once we get to $65 silver, that's when my mindset really goes, okay, Don, we're in sell mode. Remember, we have buy mode and sell mode. Buy mode is under 225 HUI. Sell mode is silver above 65. So from silver from 65 to 100, I'll be selling 80% of my stocks, maybe of my silver miners. 75 to 80%. We get the $100 silver. I should only hold 20 to 25%. I'm not going to wait till we get to 100. I'll be selling as we go up. And now with gold, I think 2,500 is probably going to be too early to sell. Mm-hmm. So sell mode for me for gold is probably going to be 2,700. That's when I get into sell mode action, right? And so I'll be selling from 2,700 to 3,500. We get to 3,500, I'll be 80% out, 75 to 80% out. Mm-hmm. So that's how you protect yourself. You sell to the top.
Excellent, Don. Well, I think that's a pretty thorough masterclass for today. Is there anything else you want to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up?
Yeah, there was one other topic that's been on my mind that I thought we'd come across that I'd like to mention. Mm-hmm. Because I've been studying the future since 1989. I'm a very unique individual. I'm an expert in gold and silver, because I've been doing it for 20 plus years, but believe it or not, it's not my number one area of expertise, mm-hmm. which is kind of bizarre, if you will. I basically have been writing metaphysical books since 1990, mm-hmm. writing about the future, writing about what's coming to America, writing about how society is going to change. And I basically been using gold and silver as a hobby, because nobody... What's coming to America and what's coming to the world is not expected. And so I can't really talk about it until we get really close to it, because it's something that people can't understand. They can't wrap their head around it. It's too much of a change. It's too dramatic a change, if you will. But I want to bring up this topic because this is the decade that everything that I've written about metaphysically and spiritually is going to start to happen. Mm-hmm. And this is the last year. I've known since 1989, I wrote this in my newsletter. It just came out. It's coming out today or tomorrow. I've known this since 1989, that the American era, the American empire, is ending in our lifetime. Well, this is the last year. 2024 is the last year of basically American hegemony. And so starting next year in 2025, America, you know, there's always been this idea that don't bet against America, that America always finds a way, if you will. Well, that premise was always based on basically the rising of America, the rising, which definitely happened, right? From the 1800s, 1900s to, you know, America basically rose to dominance. I mean, an economy today is 25% of GDP. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of this normalcy bias that is going to continue. Well, when we get to the end of this year, we're going to look back and we're going to say, what just happened? And so starting next year in 2025, America is going to go in a new direction. And there's basically... America, as we know it, is going to go away, if you will. We're not going to be in Kansas anymore. We're going in a new direction, basically. And it's very obvious. I mean, if you've been paying attention, it's become pretty obvious. What I've known for 30 years is starting to become obvious. You can see that our political system is basically dysfunctional. And on top of that, our problems are getting worse. So it's starting to become obvious that something's going to break, mm-hmm. and that we can't fix it. I mean, perfect example is last week when we basically funded the Ukraine and the Israel war simultaneously with $90 billion, right? We don't have that money. And everybody's going, what in the heck are we doing funding these wars that really aren't our wars? And we're funding them? What's going on here? When we're basically having problems and we're ignoring our own problems. That's a really good telltale sign, but it's been one after another, right? The open borders. Everything is basically slowly disintegrating. And so basically what I want to leave you with this idea is, you know, get ready for rapid change for the rest of this decade. But the good news is that we're going to come out of it. Once we get to 2030, we're going to find a new way. It's actually a very bright future. That's the good news. The good news is we're going to find a way forward in a very positive manner. Mm-hmm. The bad news is the America that we knew is going away. We're not going to do it as 50 states. It's not going to be done at the national level. This path forward is all going to be done on the local level. So the shift that begins next year is a shift away from Washington back to the states. So I just want to leave people with that. And I usually wouldn't say that, but we are, as we get closer and closer to it and people start to figure it, then I can start talking more about it. Mm-hmm. So right now, all I can do is kind of give you little pieces of it, because the overall, I write about it in my books. I mean, you can read, like, I have a book called The Path Forward if you really want to get into it.
Mm-hmm. Is that on Amazon, Todd?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, The Path Forward, yes. Mm-hmm. And so that really tells you exactly how it's going to unfold. And when you can read that first chapter, and I'm telling you, it's like a total red pill. I mean, you're like, you won't want to go tell somebody what you just read. Mm-hmm. It's like, no way, man. That can't happen. It's not what people are expecting. It's going to be very shocking. It's going to be transformational. Mm-hmm. I can't even talk to my family about it. I mean, that's how radical it is. The change is coming. It's pretty dramatic, but it's not dystopian. That's why I want to come across. The change is not dystopian. We're not going into dystopia. It's going to get better. I'll leave your audience with that.
Well, I appreciate some optimism and some positive message versus, you know, all doom and gloom, because I don't think the future is all doom and gloom. Of course, we're going to go through some tough times. You know, we need to get rid of a lot of these imbalances, whether that be in the market, whether it be in politics, you know, anywhere we look. But as you were saying, I think this is a pendulum that is going to swing back.
Yeah, I want to say one final thing. I think this is important. So if you look at since 1945, America has been in these constant wars, mm-hmm. right? And those have not occurred because the American people wanted to fight those wars. Those wars occurred because Washington decided to fight them. And as you've noticed, as time has went on and on, there's been lack of any type of transparency, especially after the war on terror, for instance. Mm-hmm. No transparency. Washington was basically just pushing this stuff down our throats, right? Well, this is the big shift, because when we go back to the states, then the states don't want to fight wars. And so Washington is not going to have, basically what's going to happen is wars are going to end, because once the U.S. retracts, we have like 200 military bases around the world. Once America retracts all those bases and basically becomes more insular, when we're state focused, mm-hmm. war basically starts ending around the planet, which is basically peace basically breaking out. Now, this is the reason why that we have a bright future. By the middle of the next decade, by 2035, war will actually be rare on this planet, which is amazing. And so it kind of makes sense. I mean, if the U.S. basically, because we've been the aggressor around the world, if we pull back, you know, the rest of the world is basically going to pull back too. So America is always supposed to be the leader of the world, if you will. This is basically going to be the first time in a long time that America actually is kind of the light of the world. We are showing the way to peace, which is mm-hmm. ironic, because we have been the aggressor for the last 50 years. And we're actually going to be the ones that basically show the way forward peacefully, which is bizarre. And it'll start to become apparent by the end of the decade. Now, a key factor of all this is money. Think about how much money it costs to fight these wars, right? Our budget deficit, we're not going to be able to fund these things. We're at $800 billion, $900 billion a year in defense spending. Well, guess what? We're going to be broke. We're not going to be able to fund it. That's the reason why this is all going to change. So I want to leave everybody with that idea. And logically, you'll see that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you can't fund wars, you're not going to have wars.
Yeah, absolutely. it would sure be a difference, like a sea change difference in how we view the world from this point.
Massive sea change, massive. Okay, Bob, thanks for having me on. Thanks for that final question.
Always a pleasure, Don. I appreciate you, going off into a totally different topic like that. It's always right. Interesting to see where your head's at.
Yeah, I'd like to set a date for the next one. Let's go for, I want to stretch it a little bit. Let's go all the way to September 1st.
Perfect. I'll put a reminder in my calendar.
Well, if it's a weekend, then we'll do the following Tuesday.
Okay. Of course, for anybody that wants more from Don, all of his gold stock data, obviously available at goldstockdata.com. At Don Durrett, 2 R's, 2 T's on Twitter, and as well as his Substack. And Seeking Alpha. You know, there's a million places to find you, Don.
Yes. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate the time.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.